Hey everybody, welcome to Missing Mara Murray. This is Tim. Before we roll today's episode, we wanted to preface it by saying that some of this information is inaccurate. Just before uploading this episode, we noticed an update James Renner posted to his article on Alden Olsen and Vester Lee Flanagan. It turns out the commenter wasn't actually Vester Lee Flanagan. We spent some time talking about it in this episode, and we wanted to leave it in because we still found it interesting and just know that this is a great example of how this case can get convoluted. Please follow us on Twitter at MaraMurrayDoc and give us a good review on iTunes if you feel like it. It does help. Thank you very much, and we hope you enjoy the show. Mara Murray was born on May 4th, 1982, in Hanson, Massachusetts. By the age of 21, she was 5'7 and 120 pounds. On February 9th, 2004, in Haverhill, New Hampshire, Mara Murray crashed her car on Route 112. There has never been a confirmed sighting of Mara since that night. If you have any information on the whereabouts of Mara Murray, please contact the New Hampshire State Police. This is the Missing Mara Murray Podcast. Welcome back to the show, Lance. Today we are going to have author James Renner back on for a great conversation, mostly about some of his blog posts recently.
Yeah, his blog posts have kind of sparked a lot of interest probably in the last week or so, I think. So we'll have him back on. We'll chat with him about those.
Yeah, he's got one that we want to go over, five clues that make no sense about this case, among other blog posts that he has written recently. I know we mentioned James A. Conrad on a previous episode. We're going to get into him. Also, Alden Howes Olsen a little bit. And the man who killed Allison Parker and Adam Ward, Vester Lee Flanagan. And could there be a link between Vester Lee Flanagan and Alden Olsen?
And if it's not a direct link, James is going to talk about the possibility of Vester Lee Flanagan being influenced by Alden Howes Olsen.
Welcome back to the show, true crime author James Renner. How's it going?
Great, great. Thanks for having me on again. You know, I'm sure I'm expecting many more trolls to comment about very minute bits of information that I put out there this time. That's always fun to parse through for a couple weeks. But as you guys have found on your own as well.
Yeah. A lot of people really focused on that sociopath comment from a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were trying to defend your comments, but do you want to add anything to that?
You guys don't have to defend my comments. Feel free to throw me under the bus. I get into it a little bit more in the book, of course. I think if you look at her actions and motivations up to the point of the disappearance, I stick by it. You know, I think this young woman was extremely smart, and I through no fault of her own, and mostly through her upbringing, had learned the means of survival, even if it was to the detriment of everybody else. So yeah, she was a sociopath. Of course she was.
On the video that Alden Olsen posted, the happy anniversary video with him cackling that he released on the anniversary of Mara's disappearance, there is a comment from Vester Lee Flanagan.
Yes. Yes. So what we're getting into now is this weird echo chamber where, because of the success of your guys' podcast, a lot more. There's so many more people that are coming into the fold here. So many more people being introduced to Morris Case. This is generating much more attention to my blog, and so people are once again coming to me with tips and information that I didn't have. And one of the people, and now here we are again talking about it, right? It's a never-ending cycle, and it's getting bigger and bigger, which is good. You know, this case needs attention, and we're seeing it working. One person reached out to me via email a few days ago and said, hey, you got to look at your YouTube page. This is the Alden Olson video that you mentioned where he's taunting the family. Now, what's interesting is, I don't know if you guys remember how all this went down, but you know, we're talking 4 years ago or so now, 3 or 4 years ago, where he put this up on the anniversary. Now, I was talking to Lance at the time, and Alden Olson tried to take that, and I figured he would try to do this. He eventually tried to delete any evidence that he had put that up there, along with the video. Now, Lance was able to download that and send to me, and then I put it back up on YouTube, and that's where it's at. So it's a record, you know, it's of history here. As a journalist, that's part of what we do. We make sure that, you know, people that are suggesting that they murdered Maura Murray can't just disappear back into the woodwork. Let's look at who this guy was, and eventually we discovered it was this man, Alden Olson. Now, then you have Vester Lee Flanagan, who made a comment that's one of the top-rated comments on Alden Olson's video. And, of course, now we know Vester Lee Flanagan as the man who murdered two journalists in cold blood on live TV last week. It was no surprise to me that Vester Lee Flanagan had commented on Alden's video. This is the type of thing that Alden has hinted that he would do for many years. And he, you know, he's been taunting me and my family, you know, since his video has gone up on my YouTube account. Now, Vester Lee Flanagan, we now know, is the man who murdered two journalists in cold blood on live TV last week. You know, he had this top-rated comment, and when he shot the journalist, he filmed it, I believe, on his phone, and then uploaded the video to both Facebook and Twitter, and went out to social media. Now, you know, that is certainly the type of thing that we know Alden, you know, loves to do. He loves to upload these things and taunt the family, taunt the investigators, and make social media part of the conversation in a way that Vester Lee Flanagan took to, and, you know, he certainly raised the bar.
So this was a year ago, right? It says 1 year ago?
Yeah, yeah.
That's really interesting. So the comparison can be made that he possibly got the idea to manipulate social media like this from the Alden video? Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, you look at what Vester did, and you got to ask, where did he get this idea? Well, yeah. We know he was very familiar with Alden Olson's videos.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. And I just want to point out that Alden had it's basically what you wrote in your blog post here about you're making attempts to see what can be done to prevent Alden from threatening you and your family. What kind of reaction have you been getting from law enforcement?
Well, when Alden Olson posted a YouTube video that was nothing but pictures of my at the time 6-year-old son, I went to prosecutors in Massachusetts. Steve Gagne is the DA out there, and I started sending him these threats as they were coming into from Alden. Alden will do things that he thinks are not quite crossing the boundaries of direct threats to my life and to my family's life, although I do believe he's overstepped those boundaries with the video of my son. And he'll do stupid stuff like send me pictures of my face on, you know, the body of Kenny from South Park, where we all know what that's saying. You know, Kenny's the one that dies in every episode. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I take that to a prosecutor, he's like, what's this? This is a cartoon. You know, this doesn't say anything to me. And it's like, you got to look at it, you know, completely. And the things that he's done over the last few years, I mean, he's been in direct contact with, you know, I taught English composition at the University of Akron. He's directly threatened me through, you know, contacting my employers there. I mean, it's a mess. This guy's stalking me. And
wait,
so I took all that. Go ahead.
He's contacted your former or your current employers. What does he do? He calls them?
Yeah,
emails them.
Emails. Yeah.
As Alden Olson.
Yeah. He'll sign it, Alden Olson. You know, he'll say.
What does he write?
You know, it just about like the weirdest, oddly threatening. You know, hi, I'm Alden Olson. I'm this, you know, this gentle old man from Hadley, Massachusetts. I'd just like you to know that your professor James Renner. And I'm not a professor, but, you know, I'll take the title at least, you know, is obsessed with this true crime of this young girl who went missing in Massachusetts. And is that really the type of person you want representing your school? And look at the way he's gone after, you know, Fred Murray and these other people, and really just trying to insinuate himself into my life. And so I took all this information to Steve Gagné, the DA. And I presented it to him, and eventually it led to this phone call between the DA, myself, and I believe it was the sheriff or the chief of police out there. And we had this phone conversation about whether or not they were going to charge Alden Olson. And during the conversation, I learned that Alden Olson had also been contacting them, trying to get them to charge me with, you know, defaming him, you know, by putting his name up on there. And also... by the comments on his creepy video, right? So we were able to take his video and keep it so that he couldn't delete it and put it up on YouTube for history, right? So there are commenters on there that are like, this guy's creepy, you know, this, you know, he's certainly killed Maura Murray, let's go get him, you know. But, you know, it's all talk on there. So he took that as threats and convoluted it so that, you know, he was trying to get the DA to come after me. And it was just nuts. You know, I'm on this conversation and I'm like, well, guys, you know, what about this YouTube video of my 6-year-old son? That's clearly a threat. And they said, well, first of all, we can't find the YouTube video because he deleted it. We weren't able to get it in time. So, you know, but they have the power to go to that service and to pull the records. And, you know, that's still sitting on a server somewhere, but they didn't want to find it. And I said, what about this video of my son? And the chief of police or whoever this was on the phone kind of laughed and said, well, you know, he got those pictures from your Facebook profile. He's like, it's kind of your fault for having your kids' photos on your Facebook profile. And that, to me, is like the weirdest backwards way of looking at this thing. Total victim blaming. Like, it boils down to the old, well, you deserved it because of what you're wearing, you know, argument. So it's just a complete mess. And then, you know, I try to put this aside, and then something like Vester Lee Flanagan happens, where this guy clearly seems to be inspired by Alden Olson. And Alden Olson is threatening to, you know, all along do something like Vester Lee Flanagan has done, and I can't get anybody to do anything about it. So I have to wait here until Alden Olson comes knocking on my door.
Jeez. It makes me wonder if Alden had any contact with Vester. I just want to read the comment that he wrote to Vester Lee Flanagan.
Yeah.
It's because it's pretty weird. He wrote, "You idiots. Why are you disliking this? He is posting this for you guys to see. He isn't the guy in the video."
Yeah, he's defending me, right?
Because it's from your YouTube account.
Yeah. Yeah, people were disliking it because, you know,
they thought you created it.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So that's Vester Lee Flanagan is kind of doing that. But the important part in my mind is that Vester was very, very much clearly aware of Alden Olson and the type of stuff he's done. And what he did when he shot this journalist is do what Alden would have done, which is film it and put it up there for the world to see. He even wrote one of these rambling manifestos that he sent after the crime to different newspapers and TV stations. And you know, that's the same thing Alden's done before. He's got these manifestos that he'll put up online or send out. And, you know, it's frightening. You know, it really is. This is, you know, directly threatening me, my family, my career. You know, it's the DA is just sitting there. So,
have you spoken to anybody in law enforcement with this connection yet?
No. Yeah. I did send it along. I'm sure the DA's aware of it, you know. I don't know. You know, another thing that I the reason why I'm trying to get them to take another look at Alden Olson recently is I was finally able to pull the public records related to when Alden got in trouble a few years back for threatening to murder members of his own family. And, you know, the DA and Alden himself have always made Alden Olson out to be this harmless guy. But you look at these police reports, and his family, who knows him better than anybody, is clearly afraid of this man. You know, he was, you know, they at one point he had an altercation involving a shotgun. Luckily, nobody was murdered, but they took away his gun for a little while. I just learned that he was able to get his gun back. So this isn't, you know, everybody is like, well, this is a harmless old guy. His family sure doesn't think so.
So Alden's got a gun, at least one gun.
At least one gun, yeah.
I just want to be clear. We're not suggesting that Alden did anything to Maura. What is his connection to the case?
Well, he suggests that he's done things to Maura with, you know, by putting the little ski ticket up there. Hey, I was, you know, 20 minutes away from the crime scene a day after it happened. I mean, there's no other conclusion you can draw that Alden Olson wants us to believe that he, you know, harmed Maura.
So I believe that was the first video that he posted, correct? He posted the ski ticket video, which was simply a Brenton Woods cross-country ski pass that had that Ken Burns type effect on it, where it's slowly zooming in to the date. And the date was 2 days after Maura went missing, 2004. So I believe it was February 11th, 2004. That's what the that's what it zoomed into. That was the first video, correct?
I think that's right, yeah.
The second video was the laughing, the happy anniversary video. But wasn't it brought to light later on that the date was photoshopped?
Oh, I don't know. I honestly was not aware of that. Now, do you believe it was photoshopped?
It was on something that Alden blogged about. He said that he did the Photoshop.
I don't know. You know, I don't put anything past this guy. But, you know, again, here we are giving him more attention. You know, is that the right thing to do, or are we just documenting the historical record? It's a funky gray area.
Do you think he actually has any knowledge of what happened to Maura? Is there any way that he really does?
I don't think so. I think he's just a guy that, you know, you see this in a lot of true crime cases, and I've investigated, you know, several. There's always that person that wants to insinuate themselves into the narrative and the storyline. I remember the Amy Mihaljevic case, which was the subject of my first book. There were a few detectives that had worked on the case that 10 years after this girl was abducted and murdered were in a church for service. And this guy stands up in the middle of service and says, I have something to confess. I killed Amy Mihaljevic. And all these detectives happened to be there, and they jumped on this guy and tackled him. He's just some nut, you know, just some nut that wanted attention. Had nothing to do with the crime, but this will happen a lot. You know, detectives deal with this. This is why they, you know, they, when some guy comes in and wants to give a confession, they really have to take a look at whoever it is to make sure that they, in fact, could have committed the crime. You know, look at the guy that came forward with JonBenet Ramsey a few years ago. You know, so, you know, that's all I think this is.
And so, speaking of people sort of taking to social media, last week we had a guy named James A. Conrad take to Facebook, and this guy is a former member of the New Hampshire State Police, and he took to Facebook on the Maura Murray Missing Facebook group, which is run by Helena Dwyer Murray, a member of Maura's family, and he said that that the New Hampshire State Police know who did this or have a very good idea of who murdered Maura. And it sounded like that they weren't going to prosecute because they didn't think they could get a conviction.
Yeah, again, this is, you know, this is some of the new information that's come out thanks to you guys. You know, obviously this guy was motivated to get back into the Maura Murray pages and blogs and Facebook profiles because of your podcast, because of the attention it's getting. So here's one of those people that came out of the woodwork. This James A. Conrad was a trooper, and he just like you said, posted on this official Facebook page that he had inside knowledge of the case and that the police knew who did it, that Maura was buried under a house, you know, not too far from the crime scene. But like everything in this case, you look a little deeper and things get a little weird. And that's what happened with James Conrad. You go back and look into his history, you start to get a sense that maybe there's a motive for him coming out and saying these things. Conrad was a state trooper until 2007. At the time, he was separating from his wife. He gave an emotional resignation at his barracks after being accused of entering his ex-wife's home. During that confrontation, he threatened to pull another trooper's gun in what appeared to be an attempt of suicide, what is known by death by cop. This led to Conrad being arrested and detained. He ended up actually suing the troopers involved for wrongful imprisonment. He was awarded $1.5 million judgment in 2008 over this whole thing. Of course, he lost his job. He has not been a trooper since then. I've learned that $1.5 million judgment was vacated after that. So, you know, does this guy have an axe to grind with state troopers? Is he just dealing with old information? Did they really believe that Maura was buried under some house back in 2004, only to, you know, after 2007, when Conrad was long gone, come to the conclusion that she ran away? You know, how much of what this guy says is truth or was true at the time? It's hard to say, but you know, on the page, when he came out with this information last week, he purported that this is, you know, he's like, you know, this is 100% true. And you know, you have to ask yourself, is it? And why is he coming out now?
Yeah, that's the question that Lance and I had, is that, you know, so if he does have an axe to grind, the question is, why would he come out now? And why talk about this case in particular? There's a bunch of cases he could have talked about to besmirch the police if that's really what he wanted to do.
And putting his face out there, his name out there, and we've actually tried to contact him. And
has he gotten back?
No, he actually deleted one of our requests.
How did he delete?
We sent him a request on Facebook, and
it
was deleted. It wasn't read. It was just deleted.
But we may have his phone number, so I think we're gonna try him sometime soon.
Yeah, I mean, I'd certainly be interested in hearing what this, you know, further what this guy has to say. I think it's pretty clear who he suspected in Maura's disappearance. You know, but again, I'm thoroughly convinced that what we're dealing with here is not an abduction and murder. You know, that's clearly the way he's looking at it. And yeah, I know there were some police that, you know, thought the same way he did early on. You have to remember, you know, one of the things that came out in my reporting is the fact that there were 4 lie detector tests given by detectives to suspects in the case. Suspects meaning suspects in Maura's murder, if that in fact is what this is. And that's, you know, so of those 4 lie detector tests, 2 of them were the bus driver, Butch Atwood. He took 2 lie detector tests. One, he reportedly failed, and asked to take it again. He had all sorts of medical conditions, bad heart, bad kidneys. You know, he died, you know, just a year or two later after these tests. The second one, according to his common law wife, was inconclusive. Now, the third test was, I believe, a guy named Claude Moulton. Who we may have mentioned before. There's this, Fred had said that some guy in New Hampshire came up to him with a knife and said, "My brother killed Maura, and this is the knife he used." And they sent that knife to get tested, and that brother eventually had to come in. But there's this fourth test that has never been accounted for. And I don't know who took that and whether or not it's this suspect that Conrad is talking about here. But yeah, they've had a number of suspects that they've looked at for murder in this case.
I just want to read a couple of his comments, if you don't mind, real quick, just to give a little basis for the audience. He said in a thread, "I have retired and no longer work for the state police, so that is a question that should be asked of them." More specifically, Russ Conte. He was the unit commander. He says, "You have to realize that prosecutors don't like to take chances and would rather let someone go free before losing a case in court." He says all that matters is their conviction rate. He later goes on to say, "I suspect that Mora is buried under the suspect's new house. Why the state police hasn't obtained a warrant to excavate that area, I don't know. They have probable cause based on statements made by the suspect himself." So the people of New Hampshire should demand answers.
Yeah, I mean, he's a trooper. He knows it doesn't work that way, you know. So that to me says there's, the motivation here is bad blood. He's obviously pointing the finger here at Rick Forcier, who I don't know if you guys have really gotten into talking about.
No, we've only mentioned him in a passing way where we've given his account of what he said happened when, he saw or thought he saw someone who looked like her running across the street on his way home from work.
Rick Forcier lived across the street from Butch Atwood on the corner there of 112 and I think Bradley Hill Road is what it was. He's a neat character. He's this kind of old surfer dude slash contractor who does slash guitarist who has these videos on YouTube where he plays some kind of goofy, almost Jimmy Buffett-like original songs. And I spent a lot of time out there, like you guys have, and one of the people I was asking around about was this Rick Forcier because, he may be the last person who saw Maura that night. He claims that he saw her jogging down 112 when he was coming home from work, if that's true. I learned a lot about him. Everybody down there likes Rick Forcier. He's this neat, kind of charismatic guy. But he came forward with a story months after I think Moore disappeared, and the police were wondering why it took him so long to come forward. And my take on that is, he's just this kind of storyteller, who likes to tell tall tales. And I think he got to talking one night and remembered a time he saw somebody jogging down 112 near the time that Moore went missing. And put two and two together and thought, oh, you know what? It would make a better story if that was Mora. And I think that's how it happened. I don't think it was Mora. I think Forcier is just this guy that likes to tell stories. He built a house. At the time that Mora disappeared, he was living in a trailer on his property, and he was building this house. And that's clearly the house that James Conrad is talking about. Under the foundation is where he claims. The body was. I certainly don't look at Forcier as a suspect. But then again, I don't think Moore has been abducted and murdered.
Have you talked to Rick Forcier?
No, I've talked to people that were close to him, family members and friends. But he won't talk to me directly. He's since moved. He no longer lives on that corner. When he moved, the police swept in and pulled his trailer over. It was being hauled by somebody that wasn't Rick. And they did a quick search of his trailer because Forcier would never let the police on his property. That might sound suspicious, but when you get into the mindset of people up in that part of New Hampshire, it's kind of mind your own business type of thing. And certainly if he thought there was even a chance they would look at him as a suspect, I can imagine why he wouldn't have wanted detectives on his property. But they didn't find anything in the trailer, otherwise he'd be arrested by now.
So there's a detail of the case that has kind of been grossly misinterpreted, and that's the phone call that Mora's boyfriend Billy Rausch received. And a lot of people think that it was Mora kind of sobbing on the other end. And then it gets disconnected. Could you shed a little bit of light on the actual truth of what that phone call was?
Yes. So, you know, again, there's so many new people that are coming into this case now. I'm getting hundreds of comments on the blog as people start delving into this mystery. And yes, this is a very frustrating clue here because it's not really a clue. This phone call that Billy got he reported at one time saying it just sounded like whimpering, like somebody lost in the cold. And everybody believes this was Maura calling him a day after she disappeared. It was not Maura. The police have known this from a few days after Billy reported this call. Lieutenant Scorinza, who was in charge of the investigation, tracked down a woman at the Red Cross, spoke to her directly, and it was the Red Cross calling Billy. They were when somebody in the military needs to get leave for an emergency like this, the Red Cross agents act as liaisons between the person and the bureaucracy of the military. And that's who this was. It was a worker with the Red Cross trying to get to Billy. She didn't want to leave a message because this is sensitive material. And, you know, she wanted to speak to Billy directly about what was going on. So she called back, you know, after that to speak to him directly. And then, you know, didn't put two and two together that, you know, that's what Billy was saying was the whimpering call. There was no whimpering. It was just somebody, you know, that you can interpret sounds as you want, you know, as they're just holding the phone before they hang up, you know, breathing as one would. So that's all it is. It was not Maura. The police have known this from very early on.
Okay, good. Thank you for
Yeah,
clearing that up.
great.
So that is not one of the 5 clues that make no sense about this case. That is, we know what that one is. But you wrote
Yeah.
a blog post recently that I really liked. It's called 5 Clues That Make No Sense About This Case, and it really, I think, it hit them all right on the head. Maybe we can start with number 5, Kate's faulty memory.
Yeah.
We were talking about her last time, so she was Maura's friend, Kate Markopoulos.
There was this party, right, that occurred the weekend before Maura disappeared. That was supposedly at the dorm room of Sarah Alfieri. Kate Markopoulos, Maura's best friend at UMass, was there too. You know, when I reached out to Kate, you know, this was just a couple years ago, she said that the room for the party was packed. There was standing room only. But she couldn't remember the name of a single other person who was there. Even the guy that walked her out. A guy walked her and Maura out of the building, she said. And then she lost track of Maura. And this guy walked Kate back to, I think, either her place or her car or something. And I said, well, you know, who else was there? And she said, oh, I don't remember. It was so long ago. But when I spoke to detectives, they have been frustrated with Kate Markopoulos from day one. She has not been helpful. Even back then, we're talking less than a week after this party occurred, she said she couldn't remember anybody from that party. And she said something weird to me once. It was an email where she said, I know you'd really like the names of people that were at that party. It's just not going to happen. I don't remember, and I couldn't help them then. And furthermore, I didn't see many of them ever again. Or something along that line. And it was a weird like slip up because it like, well, who from that party did you see again? You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, Kate has a faulty memory that's very, very well, she says it's a faulty memory, but you know, she couldn't remember anything even a couple days after it happened. You have to ask yourself why. You know, why doesn't she want to share the names of anybody else at that party who could verify that this party took place, that Maura was there, that could talk about what happened at that party. I think something important happened at that party. You know, whether it was Maura talking about her plans of what was going to happen in the next couple days, or whether something bad happened to Maura at that party. But whatever it is, Kate doesn't want us to know.
Yep. Actually, we got a someone commenting on the podcast and telling us that, you know, that they're enjoying it, but they find that some of the things that we're talking about end up being a bit repetitive. And I think it's important. I think it's intentional that you need to keep, especially these five clues that make no sense. I think it's important to keep putting them out there because these are things that are so close to what happened.
If we're going to solve this case, you know, we can look to these questions, these things that we do repeat again and again. Because I think if we had the answer to one of these things, it would really shine some light onto what happened to it. It could be the key to solving it.
Yeah, and it's important for at least myself to keep reminding myself what the facts are, and not getting kind of bogged down with all the comments that go on top of on top of all of these clues. The next one is one of my personal favorites, the family apathy. Do you want to fill us in a little bit on that?
Yes. In the history of missing women, when have you ever met a father who doesn't want a book written about the case, who doesn't want the national exposure that a book would bring? And people will say, well, of course, Fred doesn't want a book written. Look at the way you've treated him. Look at the suspicion that you've cast on him. That is revisionist history, because before I did anything on this case, before I even had a theory as to what happened to Maura, I appealed to Fred Murray and asked him asked for his blessing for this book, and told him I was going to be writing this book, and he got back to me through Helena. And made it very clear that he didn't want any book written about this case, that he was done with it. And that to me, even from back then, that was the first red flag for me, for Fred Murray. Why does this guy not want somebody to look into it?
What year was that?
I think we're talking like 2010 or maybe early 2000. No, it was 2010. It was 2010. So we're talking 5 years ago, and before I interviewed anybody, I went to Fred first.
When did you start the blog?
I started the blog in 2011.
There wasn't anything of yours online at that point.
No. I didn't start the blog until 6 or 9 months after this happened. You know, so there was nothing. You know, it was a journalist going to Fred and saying, I'd like to write a book about your daughter's disappearance because I want to find out what happened. And he said no.
He said it through Helena Dwyer Murray.
Yeah, and I tried to contact Fred directly, not just through Helena, but by leaving messages at his home and through email. And he would never respond to me directly.
And I'm a little confused who Helena Dwyer Murray is. We've been talking about her on the podcast, and we keep saying she's somehow related through marriage.
She's not. Well, she's related. Yeah, you're right. Exactly. She's related through marriage. She's related through, I believe it's a cousin of Fred's through marriage. And that gets back to the idea of family apathy, right? Like, why is this person who's three times removed from Moore's immediate family running all the social media for it? Why is she running the website? Why is she running Facebook? Why isn't it one of Maura's brothers and sisters? Why isn't it her father? You know, why didn't her mother join in the searches? Why was Giuliani up there once? Why was Kate not so involved? There's this weird apathy from the family when it comes to searching for Maura and from getting involved in it. And, you know, they've completely fallen off the radar. This is a family that is not typical. They're not acting like a family who is searching for Maura Murray.
We've got some comments lately, some questions about Maura's mother. And you say here that she was never involved in the search for her daughter.
Maura's mother's name was Lori. And she eventually, a couple years after Maura disappeared, she died from cancer on Maura's birthday, by the way. But she was healthy. In some ways, you know, as best you can be, when Maura disappeared, and she would never go up there to join in the search.
At this point, it would be, you know, that the S word, speculation. But
yeah.
Why would she not go up there? Because when I'm looking into the case, I guess I made the assumption that she was probably too sick to go up there when I learned that she had cancer.
It was not that It was not that progressed. I don't know that she even knew she had cancer at that time. All I know is that the relationship between her and Maura was pretty strained. You know, the relationship was not good between Maura and her mother. It wasn't good between Maura's mother and Julie either. It was a very difficult relationship. Maura was kind of in charge of the house when she was still living in Hanson. And she would kind of go and buy groceries and help her little brother out. And so there's not a lot of love lost there. But that said, you know, when Lori lost her daughter, when Maura disappeared, you know, any instinct as a parent would kick in, and you set that aside and you go find your kid. You know, the only reason to me that you wouldn't is that you believed that she was okay, that she was running away and that she was doing her own thing. You know, certainly if you thought there was a chance that she was abducted and murdered, you would get up there.
Let's think of the media that the family has agreed to do. There was the Chronicle episode, the Disappeared mm-hmm. episode, and the Boston Magazine article, right? And then they came out when Alden had his happy anniversary video, right?
Yeah.
Was there also Mari Povich?
No. It was Montel Williams.
Montel Williams.
Right. Fred will do media that he can control. You know, one of the stipulations he has, and I've talked to a number of the producers and reporters who have worked with him directly, is that he will tell you what questions they can ask and what questions he will answer. And he says right up front, I will not answer any questions about what happened to Maura before the disappearance. We will not talk about that. We will talk about this and this and this, and that's fine. And he knew that, you know, that's not the way I work.
The last line of the family apathy clue kind of gave me the chills when I first read it. Her brother, Kurt, wrote a song he posted on his Facebook page about Maura, asking her what the family did to her to make her run away. I have two sisters, and I can't even imagine something like that. I can't even imagine members of my family doing something to make one of my sisters run away. So I think that's what gave me the chills when I read this, that he feels so strongly about this. He wrote a song and posted it on his Facebook page.
If one of your sisters disappeared in the White Mountains, would your first response be to write a song about why she ran away, or would you believe that she was abducted and murdered? You know, certainly if you thought the possibility existed that she had been abducted and murdered, the last thing you would do is write a song about her running away. That's why I firmly believe that from day one, the family amongst themselves has always thought that this is a runaway, that Maura was getting away, that and I think that she was running away from her family. If you want to jump real quick, there, you know, a couple other parts in this, you know, five clues that make no sense. We've talked about this before, of course, but the Londonderry ping, this came out in an affidavit signed by the detective in the case, Todd Landry, where they were trying to get records from cell phone towers, and they believe that somebody called Maura from southeastern New Hampshire shortly before her disappearance, on the day of her disappearance. So as Maura was traveling into New Hampshire, it appears that somebody called her cell phone from New Hampshire.
Do we know how long that phone call is or was?
No. I mean, the police may know by now, but it seems as though they didn't know who owned the number that was calling Maura at that time.
Okay, so Londonderry, which is in the southeastern part of New Hampshire, it's pretty much right in between Manchester and Nashua, New Hampshire. The most direct route from Londonderry to Haverhill, New Hampshire, where the accident was, is Route 93 North. It's about 2 hours or 2.5 hours away from Haverhill, New Hampshire. It's 106 miles from town to town. You can go up 93 directly, or you can cut over to 89 and travel in a northwesterly direction. That'll connect you to 91 north to Haverhill, New Hampshire. Now, 91 is the route that we're all assuming Maura was taking when she left Amherst, because it's right next to Amherst, Massachusetts. Now, if you pass by Haverhill, if you're coming from Londonderry and you're traveling north on 93 and you continue straight, if you don't take Route 118 towards Haverhill, you can continue up 93 to Lincoln, New Hampshire, which is a popular tourist attraction in the middle of the White Mountain National Forest. And you can continue up to Franconia, New Hampshire, which is another popular tourist attraction. Littleton, New Hampshire is a nice little town. These are all like within the White Mountain National Forest. So there's destinations beyond Haverhill, New Hampshire that you can get to if you follow 93 up that are touristy, that are there's inns there, there's skiing, there's a lot of attractions up in that region.
If you're driving up past Londonderry on Route 93, the road that you would take to connect to Haverhill is 112, the road in which Maura Murray had the accident. They're looking for the ping from the phone that called Maura's cell phone. So they know whoever called her was near that Londonderry. So I've always wondered if somebody, so Maura's driving up 91, and whoever's calling her, I believe, was driving up 93.
This is great, because I always read this as her phone had to be in the area of the cell phone tower as well. I got so hung up on her, why she would be going up 93, that it didn't even occur to me that she's driving up 91 and she gets a call from somebody driving up 93.
Right. Now it makes sense. Now it looks logical why she was on 112, whoever was making this call.
You know how many times like I've talked about this with people and never even thought of that?
It's these little details that, you know, once you can kind of step away and look at them in a fresh way, suddenly they make sense.
Londonderry is still 2 hours and 20 minutes away from Haverhill. So I wonder what time that call came through. Is it 2.5 hours before the crash by any chance?
I think it was pretty darn close, actually. The document is on my blog. I'd have to pull it up. You'll have to see. But I believe that's around the time frame we're talking about.
So that could definitely have been someone potentially going to meet her and just passing through Londonderry on Highway 93, and they could have come from Boston or anywhere in eastern Massachusetts.
Or you know,
or Hanson.
I always wondered if it wasn't somebody that was bringing Maura her passport and some odds and ends from home. So we've also got, you know, number two on this list of clues that don't make any sense is definitely something we've talked about before, with the rag in the tailpipe. And there's been a lot of discussion about that in the last week. It still doesn't make sense in my mind. The only thing that makes sense is that you want the car to stall. And, you know, you got to ask who put it there. And there's only one person who's suggested a reason for that rag being there, and that's Fred Murray. And then, of course, you've got this $4,000 that Fred Murray makes a big point about. And, you know, that's what we talked about last time, where, you know, he's got this weird amount of cash, $4,000 on him, that he says he pulled from several different ATMs. And that story just, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that he would stop at 10 different ATMs on his way to UMass Amherst. Because this was a weekend and not he couldn't have just gone to the bank to withdraw it. So he withdrew it in a hurry by going to 10 different ATMs, it sounds, or several. It's very curious.
It is, yeah, just like a lot of things in this case.
Yeah, and the $4,000 has never been accounted for. Fred's never answered the question as to where it went.
No, I've never been near him enough to ask that question. And, you know, he won't talk to me directly, and I don't think anybody's put that question to him, except perhaps the detectives.
I really hope that Fred listens to this podcast. I mean, you think that he reads your blog, right? Or had read it at some point?
I think if he doesn't, somebody else does and keeps him up to speed on what's going on for sure.
A lot of these questions that we have about Fred can be very easily explained by talking to him. If anyone is, if anyone's feeding him the information or if he's listening on his own, I would just love to just have an explanation and we can move on.
Yeah, that goes for Fred Murray. I think that goes for James Conrad. That goes for Alden Olson. If any of you are listening, please contact us. We would love to have you on the show and ask you some questions.
Keep up the good work and good luck. And, you know, hopefully this shakes something loose eventually. You know, a lot more people are tuning in, that's for sure.
Yeah, thank you very much, James Renner, for appearing on the show again. And please buy his book. It's called True Crime Addict, How I Lost Myself in the Mysterious Disappearance of Maura Murray. It is on Amazon now, but it won't be out until May 2016. And love the cover. It's really great.
Yeah, good stuff. And thank you, James, for clearing up some things that I had previously convinced myself were facts in this case.
Yeah, you bet. No problem. Thanks a lot, guys.